of minutes. Okay, are we live? I think we are. Okay, guys, welcome back to the second part of our, the fifth edition of Jornadas Sudzelandeses. I am now very pleased and honoured to introduce you to Stacey Gregg today. Gregg, or Stacey, if you don't mind, Stacey. She is the author of an impressive number of plays such as Puv, Lagan, Huzzies, I'm spilling my heart out there, Shibboleth, Scotch, Joyces, When Cows Go Boom, and Override. Scripts for short films such as Your Ma's a Hard Brexit, and episodes for TV series such as The Innocents, Little Birds, Rivera, and The Frankenstein Chronicles. Her first feature film, Here Before, which I haven't had the chance to watch yet, was released earlier this year. She's also a performer for the stage and screen. In 2012, she was awarded the BBC Radio Drama Award at the Stuart Parker Trust Awards. Her play Lagan has also been nominated for two Off West End Awards. In addition to her already brilliant career as a writer, she has also co-created an online multimedia installation to enable theatre audiences to engage creatively with Override, as part of a project in collaboration with CRASH, the University of Cambridge's Centre for Research in the Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities. So today I'm in charge of interviewing this impressively multifaceted artist who has been interviewed by so many journalists and critics from so many different places and backgrounds. We had first invited Stacey to join us in our fifth jornada, expecting that we would be able to fly Stacey to Florianopolis. But unfortunately, as the COVID-19 pandemic extended itself, we decided to move forward with our event online. Luckily, though, Stacey very generously accepted our invitation nonetheless. Stacey, I'm thrilled to have you with us today. Thank you so much for accepting our invitation to be here in our jornada, whose theme is intersections of art, literature, theatre and technology. I also want to thank my PhD student, Jessica Suarez, who's currently doing her PhD on your plays, for compiling a huge list of your achievements, and also Melina Savi, our postdoc researcher, and Jessica for brewing some of the questions I'll be asking you today. Okay, so following the theme of this year's symposium, my questions will revolve around your work as a writer, in particular as a woman writer, your uses of and representation of technology in your work, as well as your plays as an artist in the Northern Irish, Irish and British contexts. So without further ado, my first question is, traditionally, when studying Northern Irish drama, we often think of Troubles plays and post-conflict plays as, you know, sort of historical landmarks. Many Northern Irish playwrights writing either during or after the Troubles seemed occupied with the conflict and the consequences of the conflict from a political as well as personal perspective. Some of your work is regarded as post-conflict, such as Shibboleth, which was published in 2015 with Nick Hearn Books. However, within the circles of Irish studies, you're also known as a Northern Irish playwright who moves well beyond the Troubles. As a Northern Irish playwright, how much of the Troubles, or what aspects of the Troubles do you carry in you, if at all? As the saying goes, you can take the boy out of Belfast, but you can't take Belfast out of the boy. Do you think that's your case?
Yes, thank you very much for the introduction. And I just want to say it's a real pleasure to be here and to get to talk about work. It's always a pleasure to me whenever work leads on to these kind of discussions. So thank you. To the Northern Irishness of it all, I guess like many people writing from somewhere where they're has been civil unrest or a very strong sense of identity. Sometimes it lives in quite an explicit place. So there's certainly work of mine that attempts to address that conflict and the residual effects of that head on. And then sometimes it's a bit more sideways or oblique. So I guess what I mean by that is I often say that coming from Northern Ireland means that I feel like I can hold quite a lot of cognitive dissonance in my head at the same time. So we're an area that has learned to live side by side with sometimes really quite opposing political ideologies, and that that is quite every day for us in a way that I like to celebrate, in a way that I think Northern Ireland doesn't often get celebrated for. So I think that the Northern Irish part of me and the queer part of me is very interested in collapsing simplistic binaries. And I think that thematically that flows through much of my work. So even if it isn't overtly Northern Irish, I do think that it's been informed by both my experience of Northern Irishness as a sort of duality. And then I would say secondarily to that, my queerness, my experience of gender and so on. And to the sort of post-conflict, sometimes I guess I wonder if that's such a discrete period to talk about, because there's something about the circularity of trauma, intergenerational trauma that we see play out in areas of Northern Irishness, particularly the more impoverished areas, that sometimes make post-conflict feel a little bit of a luxury. So again, I feel like I probably float between both places, work that's overtly post the sort of live troubles that we associate with the height of conflict, but also I think lives that still feel very entwined with that pain and the ongoing questions that need asked in Northern Ireland and Ireland and beyond.
Thank you so much, Stacey. And the whole issue of social class there really is important to think about, right? If you're privileged and you get to, you know, study and circulate around places like near Queens, for instance, like, you know, which is considered like a fairly neutral place in relation to the whole, you know, conflict. Or if you kind of, you're restricted to areas that are like predominantly Catholic or Protestant, in where Catholics are not really entirely allowed to go, or Protestants. So yeah, thank you so much. Since you've already, you know, kind of tackled on your Northern Irishness, my next question has to do with that. Sorry, just had a problem with my screen here. Okay. You were the first in your family to go to college and explore an artistic career. So I've been prying into your personal life. Sorry about that. I believe moving out of Belfast was key to that, I suppose. Most of your plays premiered outside of Belfast, in England and Ireland. How did you feel, or better, what did it mean to you to have Posse, for example, staged at the MAC in 2012? And Scorch staged at the MAC in 2015. I know this may sound too broad a question, perhaps, but in your view, what's the difference of having your play staged in Belfast, Dublin, or London in terms of reception and so on? And how does the Northern Irish in your plays travel outside of Belfast?
It's a really interesting question. I think those earliest plays that I wrote were very concerned with explicitly Northern Irish identity. So the first play I ever wrote, Ismene, was an adaptation of a Greek myth that was set in contemporary Belfast. Lagan was an early play also that was explicitly interrogating contemporary Northern Irishness. And Shibboleth being the obvious other example. And various little short plays in between. And of course, there was always a desire to have those, to write those for the people of Northern Ireland and have them staged there, but that didn't seem to happen for me. But you know, interestingly, unfortunately, I did, I guess, have my career truly launched in Dublin, and I had very many influential and inspiring and formative experiences via the Dublin theatre scene. And that was probably in tandem with my experience of London, because I, after university, I went down to London, but was sort of split between Dublin and London in terms of the work I was trying to make. And Dublin had a much more European outlook. So Rough Magic took us to the Schaubühne and the Theatre Treffen. And I suddenly felt exposed to the kind of theatre that I'd been trying to make, but I hadn't seen ever. It was a slower process in London to discover that kind of more experimental theatre. In terms of how that felt, I guess, I think that there was certainly an audience in both Dublin and London for those things, but the reception of that varied quite greatly. Playing Shibboleth in Dublin was a very particular experience, and I desperately wanted that play to go on in the North, and it hasn't yet. And then the work that I did ultimately have play in the North wanted to fight against, I think, traditional modes of production, and there are less opportunities for that. So Huzzy's was part gig, part play, and I actually originally didn't want it to be produced in the Mac. I wanted to tour it around like chip shops and, you know, pubs. But it ended up in a theatre building, which was fine. And then Scorch was much more mobile as a one-person show, and it definitely played with form more. And I feel really thrilled about bringing those models of production to Northern Ireland that are a bit less common, I suppose. But the journey, the experience of going away to London, to Dublin, and experiencing other theatre scenes only enriched me as an artist, I feel. I'm so sorry, someone's just playing here. I need to stop it. Technology.
It has a life of its own, a mind of its own, sorry.
Unbelievable. But yeah, I think, you know, there was an interesting conversation with Shibboleth when it played in Dublin. And you imagine that a Dublin audience are as engaged with matters Northern Irish as a Northern Irish audience, but that's the case often. And I was kind of interested and surprised by attitudes to the North. And in sort of an inspiration in many ways. So when Lagan played, there were lots of people in the audience in London who didn't know that we still didn't have, you know, or that Northern Ireland was still at the time so intensely homophobic. So I think all of those experiences have informed the mode of address that I take. I usually write in a way that's quite open, so an audience can experience the work on different levels. So even if they don't have a handle necessarily on the subtleties and nuance of Northern Irishness, there's usually something else there to lay the tracks into that.
When you wrote plays such as Shibboleth, for example, did you have a specific audience in mind? As in, like, did you have a Northern Irish audience in mind or not? Or you were already so embedded in this kind of, you know, Dublin context that you were actually kind of targeting a more kind of Irish audience?
I think in the first instance, Northern Irish, like, it was very much written to try and capture the poetry and specificity and the oral texture of Northern Irishness. So I feel like if I'd written with another audience in mind, I might have not censored that, but, you know, it wouldn't have been as strongly flavoured. But I guess, as I say, given that it was a Goethe Institute and Abbey commission, it was informed by my experience with from Dublin, and I guess the, like I said, really under what was that people didn't face barriers.
You're freezing now, Stacey. I can't really hear you. It's gotten very choppy. We lost her. Okay. We're going to give Stacey a couple of minutes to see. Okay, she's back. Hi there.
Hi. I don't know what happened there. I'm so sorry for the technical glitches.
That's fine. Happens all the time. I'm so sorry. You were... Okay, so you were talking about, you know, sort of like the, that you were already quite used to working with, you know, in Dublin. Okay, even though you had, you know, kind of like a very, your characters and, you know, you were talking about the Northern Irish texture of the play. Mm-hmm. But you're commenting on the fact that you were already kind of very used to working in Dublin itself.
Okay. And of course there are artists from the north in the south, but not a great deal of traffic. There's more, there isn't a great deal, there's less traffic than you would expect between the north and the south, I would say, and the artistic communities. And I think that's starting to change. But I was very struck by that when I started out and around the time even the Shibboleth was playing. So it was a great deal to have people travel down from Belfast to see the show. And, you know, travel down they did, but we definitely felt like a very Northern Irish company. And that's interesting to me, you know.
That's fascinating. Okay, I'm going to move on to, you've mentioned something to do with your inspiration. So my next question has to do with that. So earlier, you know, in the 20th century, women playwrights such as Alice Milligan, Patricia O'Connor, Mary O'Malley, and later on in the 1980s and 90s, Christina Reid, Mary Jones, and Anne Devlin, and the women actors from Showerbank, Double Joint, and Just Us, they started important battles and won those battles, I would say, to bring women's stories center stage, metaphorically speaking, as well as to bring women actors center stage. They have also contradicted mainstream narratives of the Northern Irish conflict, challenging the government and the media of their own times. The critics see you as someone who carries the names of those women in your own way, with your own voice and style, of course. How do you, Stacey, relate to this legacy? Do you feel or have you felt at any stage that you were part of this conversation? And, you know, if you can tell us more about your inspirations. Marina Carr has once said that a writer is a magpie. You take what you need. The whole history of writing is borrowing from the previous generation. So could you tell us about this?
There are two things I immediately think of. One is that... Sarah Kane actually used a stronger phrase. She said, "All art is kleptomania," and I guess I think I remember being asked a question like this a few years ago and misunderstanding the question. I think that and feeling a little shy that I hadn't like read the canon. You know, I hadn't read all those plays, but of course it's not literally. You know, being part of the conversation and being influenced by those plays per se, so much as feeling like an inheritor or the beneficiary of the spirit of those women. And in that sense, 100%, I'm aware of the work that they've done and their attitudes and their fierceness and indeed that that impulse to contradict and to disrupt, I think, is very deeply ingrained. It started again. Oh gosh. Okay. And so, yes, I was very aware of Sharabank, and I was, you know, there was a period around the signing of the peace agreement when the Women's Coalition were very active. And I was looking around for, you know, for role models and for, you know, I guess, you know, women who were doing their thing that I could look up to. And I also feel like then when I was based in London for a long time and working, I was constantly writing those women as well. So I think the conversation continues in that spiritual way of communing with all the strong women that have come before. And I talk a lot about my granny. She was a real matriarch, incredibly, well, technically underclass by the standards that we would talk in today. And, you know, a great figure in my life. And I've had the pleasure to meet and talk to a number of those women who, you know, that you named since. And it's very fascinating to me to hear from their perspective the experiences that they have had. And as I said earlier, the benefits that we have felt sometimes that we're not even conscious of in terms of the tracks that they have laid for us. I think stylistically, I did look to visual art and to European theatre. And as I say, I wasn't very well versed in the work that had come before. And that's something that came later for me. But, you know, that the conversation can sometimes feel very disparate and nebulous in the North. And then when you're in conversation critically with other people, there's sort of like, when you're sort of looking at it from further away, the patterns sort of fall and the connections are made. And I'm kind of fascinated by that sometimes, that I've been part of a tradition or part of a conversation that I didn't even realize was happening. So it's kind of tricky sometimes to comment on that when you're in it. But I am aware of it, and I feel very proud to be, to feel like I've been invited to, you know, to be in dialogue with that work in many ways.
I really like what you said of being a spiritual beneficiary of them, of this legacy. That's really beautiful. Okay, so moving on, still kind of, you know, commenting on all this Northern Irishness, I promise I'm going to move on to a different topic very soon. I myself lived in Belfast from 2009 until 2012. During that time, there was a strong campaign for the new North that decided that tourism in Northern Ireland wasn't about the walls, nor anything related to the Troubles, but about its modern achievements, such as the building of the Titanic, its brand new waterfront, and also around Queens. There were just so many interesting arts and music festivals going on during that time. Whenever you're back there, do you feel the North has really changed and become new? And if so, in what ways? Does it feel like a facade to you, or are those changes real in terms of the Northern Irish mentality?
This is such a complicated question. You know, I think there was a sort of New North, again, in relation to what we were talking about earlier, where, yes, obviously there were areas of the cities that looked better than they ever had, and there was development, and, you know, the film industry is a very good example of something that sprung up in recent times and is, you know, genuinely something to be proud of and fruitful and creating employment. And there's a new sense of pride in that area. But at the same time, you know, the rates of poor mental health, the intergenerational PTSD, rates of suicide, deprivation, you know, these social elements that continue to not improve. And that's that's troubling. And I moved back just before the first lockdown, and I've had a few of these conversations recently. And what I feel like I hear more and more is that discontent between what unites not just working class people, but I think people in general at the moment. We want better healthcare. You know, we want to look at education. We want more integrated schools. And these things aren't matching up with the politicians. And I think that's always been the case, but I do think the landscape is slowly really changing. And some of those big changes that have happened recently, like equal marriage, or, you know, the woman's right to choose, there's that disconnect basically between what people want and the sort of very calcified political structures is becoming something really untenable. So I think it's both things. I think that desire for change shows that there is a new Northern Ireland. I really do feel that, and I think the younger generation coming up have much higher expectations. You know, they're digital natives. They see what people in other countries and cultures have, and they don't understand the dysfunction here because, you know, they weren't part of that generation. So I think ultimately, like, that demand will only grow, and we'll see that, I think, in the next, with the next generation over the next, you know, decade or so. And I find it very exciting, you know, it's about time. So I think it's complicated and uneven, and we've still got a ways to go. And people like Lyra McKee were trying to talk about this stuff, trying to join those dots. And, you know, hers was a voice that should have burned bright. And there's something horribly poetic about what has happened. But again, we are talking about that. I feel there's a level of national discussion, and I think that can only push us forward.
Thank you. That's, you know, quite optimistic and really nice to hear. Actually, I don't know if you know, but currently in Brazil, we're, you know, going through a very deep ideological divide. But of course, we can't, you know, compare to the troubles, but it is really kind of, you know, splitting families and, you know, splitting, you know, long-term relationships. You know, it's really good to hear that, you know, there's hope, you know, things can change. So, yeah.
I think you have to be hopeful. And I do, a few people have remarked on my point of view seeming like almost like optimistic. And I just, you know, I kind of can't be any other way. And like I said, sort of at the very beginning, there are certain aspects of Northern Irishness that, despite its trauma, despite its conflict, despite all of those things, I feel we can hold up and celebrate, and that those things make me hopeful. So, you know, yes, we get pushed back 2 steps, but then a wave will come and we'll push forward 4 steps, and I hope the same for you.
Absolutely, thank you very much. So now I'm going to move on to questions that are more specific to the theme of our symposium and that are very present in your work. In the afterword to Shibboleth, for example, you mentioned the context and reasons for writing about walls and humans in Squat and Override. You know, you deal with questions of boundaries, of gender, and between human and machines. Those issues are all central in those plays. In those two plays. Could you talk to us about the ways your plays approach them, about your inspirations or your motivations to dealing with those topics? I know that you kind of, you know, tackle them a little bit, you know, kind of talking about binaries. What is the importance of bringing such discussions to the theatre?
Hello, sorry, it just froze there. So sorry, just to, I I missed the very end of your question.
Okay, yeah, it's getting a bit glitchy. Can you hear me now? Okay, there's a bit of a delay.
Yes, I can hear you
Can you hear me, Stacey?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, there's a bit of a delay. I'm going to repeat the final bit of my question.
Can
Okay.
you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Okay, so I was just asking you to talk to us about the ways your plays approach, issues that deal with the boundaries between boundaries of gender, human machine, since those are central issues to Scorch and Override, for example. And the whole thing about walls and humans and Shibboleth, for example. Could you talk to us about the importance of bringing such discussions to the theatre?
I think, again, just to slightly reiterate some of the things I've touched on, I think that my approach to form in theatre is very often to disrupt and to ask questions and invite curiosity. So for me, taste-wise, I'm less interested in theatre that tells audiences or operates simply on a naturalistic level. I'm interested in pushing ideas together or breaking apart or interrupting, disrupting ideas or received truths and seeing what happens. And so I think formally I do that, and thematically quite often that means poking around at the edges of things that sometimes we would rather not. And I think that preconceptions about things such as bodies, a sort of corporeal essentialism are sort of is ripe, is great territory. And I return to it clearly through different works. Again, I feel like the poetry of performance is such that you can move limbs or take people on those journeys. That for me, that's the beauty and the freedom. And it's messy and sometimes boundaryless, and I'm excited by that. And I'm excited by the density often of that experience. And I think, plays like Override and Scorch are in dialogue with each other. And some of those earlier plays that I wrote as well, there are clearly preoccupations, and sometimes they're very sublimated in the material, but, like many writers. I'm the filter through which my preoccupations seem to persistently emerge.
Octavia Butler once said that she writes about the things that she fears. This is how she deals with her own anxiety and her fears. So I think my next question has to do with that as well. The science fiction author and critic Joanna Russ has argued that sometimes the science fiction author creates a story in order to reflect on something one would like to prevent. Ursula K. Le Guin, though, says that the science fiction author isn't in the business of predicting the future, but of describing the world as it is in the present. Okay, so things that you want to prevent and things that are actually happening now. When you wrote Override, do you think you were leaning towards the first or the second claim? Additionally, I'm going to let you answer this bit first. Sorry, go on. It's a very long question.
I'm going to cheat and probably say a little bit of both. I don't think that they're mutually exclusive. I think that we are more commonly experience what we consider to be dystopia or sort of technophobic sci-fi oriented. And I don't see myself as technophobic. I'm probably the opposite of technophile. But I think that there are conundrums and moral questions that we think of as sci-fi that are completely contemporary. We are living through them right now. And I think the public discourse is a little out of step with the reality of where we are. And so a lot of my work that's interested in scientific progress and the frontiers of that and where it meets ethical questions, I probably in the present day, and also it's my preference to favour stories that feel sort of not amoral, but there's a neutrality of them about them. Like, I don't want to pass judgment, certainly not as a playwright. They're not dystopian. Because that's telling an audience how to feel and what to think. Ursula K. Le Guin is a perfect example of someone who understood that great art gives us the tools to interrogate and challenge the present. Through that genre or through that lens.
And why did you explicitly locate Override in the present and not the future?
I think for exactly those reasons, so that we don't disconnect with those characters, so that we don't feel alienated by it, so that it feels the sort of existential horror of it, if you like, is a sort of alternative possible world.
Sorry, Stacey, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second.
Much more interesting.
It's very glitchy again. Our technician has suggested that you stop your video. It might improve your audio. Would you like to try that? It would be a pity, but you're freezing again.
Stop my video?
Yeah. Let's see if this is okay. Shall we try this way? Sorry. This really feels like Override, you know, like.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, you're saying.
No, I am so sorry. I did not know what happened to the connection. So, sorry, where did I get to before I glitched out?
Okay. Would you like to just go back a little bit of saying that you wanted your characters in Override to be relatable? You didn't want your audience to be alienated from their reality. Are you there, Stacey? I hope Stacey hasn't become violent. Okay, let's wait. Hopefully she will come back soon. Sorry guys, Stacey's having connection problems. Okay, Heidi, so if you don't mind just
Hi there,
pasting.
I'm here.
Oh, hello, you're back. Hi. Okay. I was just saying that I'm
I'm
hoping that
here, yeah, I'm
you haven't
oh
become
gosh, this
Violet.
is just I'm so
Okay, Stacey, I'm hoping that you can hear us at least. There are some comments coming from the audience members. Can you hear us? It really feels like we're, kind of inside override, this is very interesting. We're in the
I'm
play.
frying on my passion. No, that's not working. Oh my God, this is.
Okay, are you trying to use two different devices? Is it?
Can you hear me?
I can, yeah.
Okay.
Stacey, in the meanwhile, I'm just going to read a comment by Paige Reynolds. She
Yes.
says that she is a huge fan of your work and thanks for the shout out to optimism as one engine, however erratic, for meaningful social change.
Oh, thank you. Yes, my pleasure.
Okay, I think your audio is great actually. Can we carry on?
Okay, let's give it a go.
Okay.
Yes, please. I'm so sorry. Let's try.
Let's try again. Yeah. Okay. Would you like to just kind of, wrap up your ideas on locating override in the present?
Yes, I don't know how much of that you caught, but I was simply saying that it's much more disconcerting to feel like we're in an alternative present. And there is a, to me, there's a sort of low-level existential horror in that that I find quite delightful. But yeah, simply put, it's much easier to relate to those characters, and I think that it's more truthful as well. To be in a world that's familiar to ours.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so a bit on boundaries again. In the notes to Override, you cite the influence of Donna Haraway's Cyborg Manifesto, in which, among other things, she troubles the boundaries between human and technology, human and the non-human, nature and culture. And there are also the influence of Patricia Piccinini. I don't know how you pronounce her name, it's probably an Italian name. Hybrid forms that are also present in Override, although she's actually Australian, right? It's relevant to consider that Northern Ireland is no stranger to the idea of boundaries and to the fact that they cannot contain what they wish to close off. Haraway, in fact, argues that the manifesto is an argument for pleasure in the confusion of boundaries and for responsibility in their construction. In Override, Violet has such a playful approach to the human, non-human, and human slash technology boundary that I'm wondering how and if you're playing with boundaries in the play has any connection with the idea that boundaries are actually utopian and an impossible construction that we hopelessly insist on.
Absolutely. I think that's a sort of distilled celebration of exactly what is often behind what I'm hoping to explore and interrogate. Boundaries are usually artificial constructions You know, and getting under and behind what has led to those boundaries is often very interesting, because, you know, they become familiar, they become invisible, they become accepted, normalized. And I'm always very interested in trying to see the unseen or defamiliarize the familiar. And again, it's that thing about disruption and interruption. So yes, in general, boundaries is a great territory. You know, it's in some ways it's kind of you know, it's I'm trying to articulate the analogy I'm trying to make, but it's like, is dialectic is the, you know, is the condition of this is that this is one position and that's the other position, and how that interacts. And to me, visually and formally, again, those boundaries are natural points of dialectic. And so it's probably instinctive on many levels, but also quite intentionally constructed, that those are the zones in which, you know, my work often finds itself.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you so much. Moving on to my final question, actually. We might be getting more questions from audience members as well. I'd like to move on to your creative processes. I've watched the clip of your first feature film here before. Quite disturbing in a very good way. The clip was available on the Bankside Films channel on YouTube, and I'm looking forward to watching it. How did it feel to direct and write your first feature film? Could you tell us a bit about the differences between writing for the stage and writing for the screen?
Sure. I mean, it was an incredible experience, and you know, I got to work very visually and work with great performers. Has it frozen? Can you hear me?
I can, yeah. Go on.
Oh, great. just about, oh my goodness. I think that the visit to directing film and my attraction to cinema isn't completely divorced from the visually led theatre work that I've made. And although, you know, the film is probably more well behaved, it definitely still, again, shares some of those interests in coexisting ideas and disruption. And the rhythm of the film is quite dissonant, deliberately so, and sort of lives in the world of the uncanny. So I don't think it's a total departure for me, but I do reserve, I think, the right to work very differently in those different mediums. So I think Stacey the filmmaker is probably quite different from Stacey.
You're gone again. Stacey, can you hear me? Okay, so I think she's gone offline again. Just wait until she comes back.
Back.
So we can... Okay, hi. So you're saying that, you know, you're talking about Stacey, the playwright. And you're about to complete your sentence and then you're gone. Can you hear me, Stacey?
I'm back.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, sorry, where did I drop out?
Okay. So you were talking about the differences between Stacey, the playwright, and Stacey, the film script writer and director.
Great. A perfect egotistical place to drop out. but yes, I guess I was.
Okay, it's very glitchy again. Sorry, Stacey, we can't hear you anymore. You're gone again. Can you hear me?
Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Hello?
Hello, hello, can you hear me? Okay, Stacey, can you hear me? I don't think she can hear me anymore. Hello, Stacey.
Hello, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay, I can hear you. There are two more comments from audience members. Can I just read them to you?
Hello? Yes.
Okay. Okay. So this one is again from Paige Reynolds. Hi. Hello. Can you hear me? Hello. Okay. I think we might just need to really wrap things up right now because there's another panel coming up. Hello, Stacey. Where are you? I can hear your soundscape, but not your voice. Yeah. Hello. Hi, Stacey. Yeah. Stacey just wrote down that she is heartbroken by this connection. Yeah, me too. Okay, guys. So I'm just going to read one more comment from Lance Petit. He says, that would be a great question, crossing media boundaries. Yeah, a really kind of interesting topic. And also Paige Reynolds, she was interested in, you know, hearing more about the changes, how theater and film, how that changes your relationship to each form and imagine audience in the shape of narrative. Could you hear me? That was the last question.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay. Did you hear that last question?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Would you like to address that?
Yes. I just want to give my absolute abject apologies for this connection. I just had no idea what has happened today, and the timing is just so typical. So I just hope that it wasn't too painful to sit through. I think the quality of attentiveness is the question in terms of what medium you're working in. So I think when I work in cinema, the quality of attentiveness is on a certain level, and you are imagining people in a cinema space. Whereas when you work with theatre, it sounds like a cliche, but of course you are anticipating live bodies in communion in a room, and the degree of attentiveness is different again. So for me, I don't mind that people drift in their heads in a theatre space. I quite encourage that within reason. So I think you are always mindful of people's expectations of the medium, and as I say, the quality of their attentiveness. And also, I guess, what is considered conventional. You know, cinema has been historically incredibly rich and experimental, but we're now conditioned to very sort of mainstream fare. And I think that can be a bit of a shame, but also, as you know, as long as you know what you're working within and how to subvert that without, again, sort of misstepping or alienating an audience, you can have a lot of fun. And then also, I guess, never underestimating that audience either. I think there's an assumption, you know, that you can be more intellectual, say, with, you know, theatre than perhaps mainstream cinema. And I don't subscribe to that. I think that audiences are incredible and receptive and intelligent. And if your work is careful and takes care of its audience enough, then you can be those things in any medium.
Stacey, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we need to wrap things up now because we're moving on to the next panel. So happy to have you with us in spite of, you know, all the glitchiness of the connection. And there are loads of, you know, commentaries popping up. I can probably, you know, write them to you and send them to you via email. Okay. So, okay. So thank you so much for being with us. And it's been an honor. Thank you so much.
Same. Thank you. Pleasure.
Bye-bye. Really nice meeting you. Bye.
Hello.